Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Okay, hello everybody. My name is Ursula Hackett of the New Books Network, New Books in Public Policy podcast. Today, I'm delighted to welcome the two authors of the book, The Judicial Tug of War, How Lawyers, Politicians, and Ideological Incentives Shape the American Judiciary, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. I've got Adam Boniker, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Stanford University, and Maya Sen, who is Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Now, I enjoyed this book very much. It deploys one of the largest data sets ever amassed on lawyers and judges' political ideologies in order to shed light on fights over the American judiciary. And first of all, I'd like Maya to hear a bit about how this project came about. So can you tell me the origin story for The Judicial Tug of War? How did you and Adam come to co-author this project?
So Adam and I have been conversing about topics in the space for almost 10 years. We met kind of by chance when Adam was visiting at the University of Rochester when I was there as an assistant professor. And Adam was presenting his very interesting and influential work on how to scale ideologies for the mass public, essentially. And this is part of Adam's dissertation work that he's published extensively on, and you should check it out. It's excellent work. And Adam and I got to talking about how useful his work could be for studying the judiciary in the United States. So for other kinds of political actors, we have very good measures on how to evaluate or estimate ideology because we can look at the votes of most people. Like we can look at how Congress members vote on bills and how the president responds or signs bills or does not sign bills. But it's much harder to do when you look at judges because judges don't vote on bills the way that congressional representatives do. A lot of them sit and hear cases on their own, or if they sit with colleagues, it'll be one or two colleagues, probably two other colleagues. And it makes it much harder to scale votes the way that you would scale for members of Congress. And so Adam's methodology, which relies on campaign contributions and financial disclosure data, was very exciting to learn about because it opened up a host of possibilities for studying how ideology is represented in the judiciary. And so that was the initial spark that started a research agenda that I think has encompassed something like 10 papers plus the book. But over time, we got to talking about different components of the judiciary, how it reflects or does not reflect the population, whether and to what extent it reflects the interests of politicians. And then we gravitated over to this idea of thinking about the legal profession as an independent and politically active constituent. And so over time, we got to thinking about this framework of the tug of war. So that's kind of a long way of answering the question of how we got to the book. But it started off by just talking about the methodology and how we could apply that to interesting questions looking at the judiciary.
And one of the things that I find fascinating as a Brit looking in from the outside here and your work is, and we have a fair number of lawyers in our own parliament, but the numbers for Congress are absolutely extraordinary. It's such an outlier in terms of the proportions of lawyers in American politics today and sort of the enormous influence that they have had in American politics and history over time. And so what are your sense, Adam, of why it is that there are so many lawyers in American politics, and what are the consequences been of that enormous representation of judicial interests?
Well, the history of sort of the political power of lawyers in American politics goes back a very long time, actually all the way back to the colonial era. So part of it was inherited from the British system, where lawyers have for a very long time also been very important to the political system. But the United States, the sort of path of development of American political institutions in many ways developed hand in hand with the legal profession, and many of the interests of the legal profession and the culture really was very prominent. So if you look at the number of lawyers in the U.S. Congress over time, going back to the beginning of the U.S. Congress, there were periods where nearly 70 to 80% of the House and the Senate were lawyers. We're now only around half of the total body of both chambers, but that's still a massive overrepresentation. And this is, we think, has had a number of important consequences in American politics. It's not terribly surprising that it has made being a lawyer much more lucrative in the United States because of the way that the political power of the profession has spilled over. But I think most importantly, and what we really zero in on in the book, is this notion that one of the consequences of the political power of lawyers in American politics has been the elevation of the courts and courts as this very important political institution, one that makes a lot of crucial decisions about what American politics and American life is going to look like. And this is, and as a consequence of this, this has made the courts, especially the Supreme Court, this sort of prize within American politics, and has set the stage for these huge political battles that we see raging over who's going to control the judiciary. And it's something that really sets the United States apart from most other democracies, and something that we really think is an important thing to understand that comes out of the book.
I think this idea of why there's so many politicians who are lawyers is really interesting. And I think Adam and I, we touch upon this a lot in our book, but there's even more that's interesting and worth thinking about. I actually presented portions of the book at a talk at Harvard Law School earlier this year. And I know Adam's presented our work there as well. And it's really interesting to see the reaction of the law students when they hear portions of our book, because to some of them, it's actually very obvious. Like, many students go to law school in part because they're very interested in politics. And there's no kind of finishing school for politicians. But law school has sort of served that role in the United States for a very long time. And so if there are people who are interested in politics or pursuing a career in politics, one of the first things they'll do, in the United States at least, is they'll go to law school. And so many people have taken that path. And if you go to top law schools today, there are many students who are interested in the law, primarily because it's a stepping stone to a career in politics. And so they're laying down these networks, informal and formal networks, for potential careers in politics. Like, I will say that I don't think all students are like this. And I think all students kind of sense that there's great uncertainty about a career in politics. And so some pursue it and some don't. But I think there's no question that many students who end up in law schools do so because they're interested or would like to keep that possibility open.
And what you're describing in this book is all these many ways in which this legal realm and the political realms are so intertwined with one another, and the conflict that comes out of that. I mean, Adam mentioned this. So there's this central concept in your book about the tug of war. That's the sort of heart of your analysis of judicial politics. Who are the combatants here, and what exactly are they trying to do? I mean, what's the beef? What's the issue?
The tug of war metaphor is what we use to basically describe the fact that the courts in the United States are a political prize, because whoever controls the courts controls a very important part of policymaking in the United States. And you can conceive that in different terms. Like, you can think of the courts as what prevents progressive policy from moving forward if perhaps you're in the more conservative part of the spectrum, right? You view the courts as being very important to stop policies that you don't like. If you're more liberal, maybe you see the courts as being important, an important pathway to protecting minority rights and reproductive rights. So no matter where you start, where you stand politically, the courts are a very important prize for you. And you want your best to have people sit on the courts who represent your policy and political preferences. Now, this tug of war, so the courts are the booty. So who's fighting over them? Well, there's at least two players in the tug of war that are pulling, sometimes on the same side, but sometimes totally in conflict. So one is politicians, because politicians want very favorable judges sitting on those courts. They want, you know, if you're Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate minority leader, you want people like Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, and you will do whatever it takes to get those people on the court. But if you are a member of the legal profession, and this is where we, I think, really contribute to understanding the composition of the courts. If you're someone who's an elite lawyer, you also want your interests represented on the courts. And you, for the reasons that Adam talked about, you elite lawyers have historically had a very close connection to the courts. Judges are elite lawyers. They were trained as lawyers. They come from this environment. They share the same sort of practical and business preferences that the rest of the legal profession does. And they, many of them also share kind of the same ideological preferences too. And so if you're a member of the legal profession, you also want to see the courts reflective of your policy and political preferences. And so we think the judicial tug of war sort of can, you can think about it in terms of politicians and the legal profession kind of fighting over what the courts eventually look like. Like sometimes they're pulling on the same side. Sometimes there's harmony between those two. So politicians are really in line with the legal establishment. You get that mostly in kind of more liberal leaning places right now for reasons that Adam and I are, we can talk about at great length. But sometimes they're really in conflict, and you see that in a bunch of different states, American states, that the legal profession is really at odds with political elites, in particular when Republicans are in control of like a state assembly or something. And then you see a lot of conflict. And so that's really what we mean. This conflict between the legal profession and politicians, that really is at the heart of the judicial tug of war that we describe in the book.
Mm-hmm. So I'd love to come to this point about kind of alignment and not being aligned, and this sort of symbiosis relationship that you describe between lawyers and the political class, at least at various points in certain points in American history. And so I'd definitely like to come to that. But I'd like also just to pick up. I mean, you mentioned Amy Coney Barrett, and of course she was just saying only a couple of months ago that she's talking about the court and saying, you know, we're not a bunch of partisan hacks. And you get these sort of the constant refrain from all justices actually on the Supreme Court saying, you know, we're not partisan, we're not a partisan institution. And there's this sort of sense in which courts feel the need to kind of hide their true motives. They sort of think of themselves as non-partisan institutions. Of course, you're showing in the book that they are very partisan indeed. And that's something which I and many, many others in our own work sort of find reinforce that vision. And so, I mean, I just, maybe this is a silly question, but just, I mean, who are they kidding? I mean, who exactly, does anyone believe that courts are actually apolitical? Where's the sort of legalist model in all of this? I mean, Adam, I don't know whether you have any thoughts on this. It's perhaps a bit of an unfair question.
Yes, I have many thoughts. I'll back up. So the question of who are they kidding? I think there's just sort of a little song and dance that often goes on the courts because of the sort of tenuous position that they're in, that they don't want to outwardly be or be seen as a actively partisan or political institution. Judicial legitimacy in many ways is tied back to this notion that is this impartial decision-making body that will be deliberative and be fair. We have ample evidence that in many areas of law, partisanship just swamps everything else that's going on in terms of how justices are making decisions. It's not universal. There are many areas of law where partisanship doesn't seem to be particularly predictive or determinative about how judges are ruling. But in the areas that the public seems to care about most, like abortion, civil rights, education, you do see this really strong partisan element to what's going on in the courts. Now, the courts have this sort of difficult game to play, right? So if you were a politician and you were trying to claw back reproductive rights in the United States. If you were a Republican, you would probably be trying to take credit for that. As a justice on the Supreme Court, you may want to achieve that policy goal, but you don't want credit for it. So they have like a very different set of public-facing incentives relative to what you would get from a politician, even if the actions or the policy outcomes that they're creating actually look very much like what you would get from a legislative institution. And I think this sort of plays back to this notion that Maya was talking about in terms of partisanship does have an important role to play in sort of this fight over the judiciary. And one of the sort of alignment periods of alignment and misalignment that we see in American politics. We've seen this happen over multiple centuries now. And there have been periods when the legal profession, and by virtue of that, the courts, because the judges are all drawn from the legal profession, were very conservative. So one of the biggest fights we saw over the judiciary was during the Franklin Roosevelt administration, during the New Deal era, where policy was moving very far to the left relative to where it had been at the time, and the courts were sort of the stopping point for a lot of these progressive New Deal policies at the time. And it was a very conservative institution. And what we saw was politicians at that time pushing back and saying, we need to inject more partisanship into the courts because the courts are already partisan, even though they say they aren't. And if we don't put more liberal pro-New Deal justices on the court, it's going to be a problem for policymaking for politicians. And so that's sort of a dynamic that we saw emerge very clearly then. Things have reversed in a lot of ways, that the legal profession tends to be much more liberal than the average citizen or the average politician in the United States. And so partisanship and this sort of fight, but it really sort of is an important element of this overall fight between where the bar lawyers are in terms of what they want the judiciary to look like and what the two different parties want. And that really creates right now in an era of extreme polarization, a really serious dynamic where there aren't many, many politicians who are going to go out and say that the courts aren't partisan if it doesn't suit them in that given moment. And so, Republicans aren't going to say it so much about the Supreme Court, but they may not be so upset about saying about certain state Supreme Courts that may be more liberal than they otherwise or could be relative to politicians in that state.
I think I've come around to having a more charitable view of the justices themselves. I think some of them who say that they're not partisan hacks genuinely believe that they're not partisan hacks. But of course, I'm not sure we should take what they say at face value. We should pay attention to their votes and kind of how those line up with what we would expect given what we know about their ideology and partisan appointments. So I think some of them genuinely believe it. And in fact, Justice Breyer just wrote an entire book about it. So I have no reason to doubt that they are genuinely held views by the justices and other judges that they are not partisan or motivated by partisan or ideological considerations. But the evidence is really hard to ignore. So they might believe it, but it's still, it's still descriptively accurate. So that's kind of where I'm at after having listened to a lot of justices claim that they're not voting in a partisan way.
Right. So we're not in the business of judging the sincerity or otherwise of any particular judge or justice's positions. Yeah. But certainly what we can do from on the basis of these wonderful data sets that you've amassed and all this brilliant statistical work that you're doing in the book is that we can judge by their actions and we can look at their behaviors and we can look at their writings. And there's all sorts of things that we can say about persistent partisan relationships.
Well, I think I think that kind of on this point, the justices and the judges in general are very sensitive to their reputations and they care a lot about what law professors and legal elites think. And so it's very important for them to at least kind of pretend or hold out that they are not being motivated by partisan politics, because if all of a sudden they admitted that, it would kind of make the whole facade crumble, right? Like, what's the point of going to an elite law school if at the end all you have is just partisan voting, right? What's the point? What's the point of these fancy oral arguments when in the end it's just being predicted by partisan affiliation? So it's a bit like they have to go through these motions and kind of believe this and reinforce this, because otherwise the whole facade just starts to crumble.
Right. I mean, they have this language, right? They have the language of the law in which they are able to express these visions. And so they are constrained in that way. And I think this comes to this point about alignment, because one of the things that, I mean, I love this book. I just love it. I mean, you've got this incredible data set, but you've also got this amazing historical material as well. And you're kind of coming back to the very, origins of these disputes in time. And so, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is, and this is what Adam was talking about just now, and we've got this symbiotic relationship, at least in these early years, where you've got the alignment of the interests of the lawyer class and you've got the political class, and they are in lots of ways connected with one another. But then you sometimes have these periods of time where one is skewing one way ideologically and one the other way. So you've got lawyers who are in this way, you're talking about how they're skewing left, and then you've got judges skewing right and politicians skewing right. And these interests are not always aligned ideologically, even if they are aligned sometimes professionally. And so, I mean, Adam spoke to this a little bit, but Maya, I wonder if you could sort of take this up again, this point about polarization and how that kind of those tensions can grow and maybe damage that symbiosis that you're describing that seems to have maybe occurred for periods of time.
It's really interesting. And, you know, I think one point to highlight here is that Adam and I wrote the book about the legal profession and kind of this tension between legal elites and political elites. But honestly, in the United States, I think, and Adam can weigh in on this if he disagrees, but it's a tension about expertise more generally. So in the last decade and a half, there has been emerging polarization that corresponds to education. So among highly educated professions, lawyers, doctors, but also scientists, engineers, people with high levels of expertise across different policy arenas, those people are leaning left and left and left and kind of more increasingly more left. And that generally creates potential problems for a right-leaning party, because if you're trying to recruit and attract expertise, or you're trying to claim expertise, and the experts are increasingly leaning toward the other side, it presents obvious challenges. And so you can try to do a couple of things. You can demean expertise. You can say expertise is politicized, and you can attack the experts. And we've seen a lot of that outside of the law, right? I mean, the whole COVID-19 pandemic has basically been an evolving series of attacks from the right on expertise. Or what you can do is you can politicize the process, and you can make it so that the experts that are chosen, whatever in whatever field, environment, climate, pandemic science, public health, in whatever law, in the case of judges, whatever field, you want to introduce political metrics to select your experts. You want to pull. In our book, we call this politicization, right? So you want to introduce ideological selection to get the experts that you want. And so as the parties polarize, as these patterns become more and more, I guess, real and concrete, you see kind of attempts to introduce selection on the basis of ideology, politics, things that correlate with those things. You politicize school boards, you want to elect judges, you want to have political appointments across all facets of government. And so, like, what we see in judges and what we document in our book is that in places where that's happened, you see largely Republican Party leaders try to move toward the election of judges or the political appointment of judges or some sort of political vetting that then ends up selecting the kind of judges that you want ideologically. But I guess a cautionary point is that that pattern is not limited to judges. And we've certainly seen that emerge in the last 4 or 5 years.
And there's some great stuff in the book about, I mean, you're comparing the sort of lawyers with other comparable professions, aren't you? And you're sort of thinking about how ways in which they might be skewing themselves ideologically as well. I mean, I was just wondering about that. I mean, because clearly there's some sort of generational effect, isn't there, right? And you're talking about this happening over a period of time in the last few decades, that those people in those particular professions moving towards the left. Is there a life cycle effect as well? I mean, you talk, I think you mentioned at one point age, but you know, because I'm just trying to get a sense of just the scale of the issue here, because it's the, you know, you're describing these the situation in which the political class is moving to the right in various ways, at least in the Republican Party. You've got the sort of tack to the right, but at the same time, you've got a sort of lawyer class that's going towards the left. I'm just wondering how worried we should be about this, and whether there might be some, Adam, I don't know whether you want to speak to this, that sort of whether the life cycle effect might save us. Or, you know, is this a sort of people are just tacking all to the left, and you see that being the sort of the chief dynamic going into the future?
So in terms of life cycle effect, are you thinking more of, so you have these generational effects and then
right, people becoming more conservative, yeah, as they age?
So there is some evidence that that does happen at some level, but it's usually as people get older, at least in American politics, that move to the right is pretty subtle. And it's much smaller than the overall generational trends that we see basically pervasively through American politics right now. But they were really foreshadowed by what we saw among the professional class, the highly educated class. So I'll explain a little bit what I mean by that, because Maya gave a very, very eloquent and helpful explanation of why this really matters. So overall in American politics, young voters right now, generationally, millennials, Gen Z, are very, very Democratic. We've seen periods like this before. Actually, during the New Deal era, people who grew up in the 1910s and 1920s happened to be extremely Democratic, and they voted Democratic their entire lives. And you can see this in sort of voting trends over time. But essentially, the year you were born, for instance, is actually a pretty good predictor of your partisanship. And right now, we're in a moment where about two-thirds of people who are in their 20s are voting Democratic, but it's even significantly higher among the professional class. So Maya and I have another paper with several of our frequent co-authors where we look at this question of ideological uniformity within the legal academy. And part of that project is looking at how liberal graduates of elite law schools are. And it's, in a lot of elite law schools, actually the majority of them is about 80 to 90% that are liberal. And this is not unusual for the professional class. Among doctors now, a profession that just as recently as the 90s was a sort of bedrock Republican constituency as an interest group. Younger doctors now, they're been recently on the floor of the AMA advocating for universal healthcare in the United States, which is a complete reversal. And you see this in the data very clearly as well, that doctors, young doctors, are very liberal, and you see this generational turn that's really fast. And since this is happening across all these areas of expertise, it does have some real ramifications. And I think one of the potentially scarier aspects of it is if conservatives and Republicans feel like scientific or empirical expertise are not in their interest to promote, that becomes a real problem for a functioning democracy. And that's the type of thing that like we have been seeing play out with the COVID pandemic. And I think it's gonna get worse. I don't think it's gonna get better, at least in the intermediate term.
So this is really fascinating. And I think in particular, this point about the way elite law school graduates coming out and being very much on the left side of the spectrum, and the relative scarcity of conservative law graduates being quite an important factor in your analysis in relation to some of the power of these conservative legal organizations like the Federalist Society and so on. And I mean, you might think that that's about strategic nous, you know, that these organizations are just great at organizing, they're great at raising money, they're great at what they do, but and then that's why they're so powerful and prominent. But you're sort of drawing, I think, also from this point about just the scarcity story with respect to conservative graduates that's maybe helping to explain the prominence of some of these conservative legal organizations. I wondered, Adam, I mean, would you be able to just elaborate on that a little bit for our listeners? I think that's quite an interesting point you make in the book.
Yeah, so one of my favorite graphs in the book, I remember we made this early on, it was Maya had this idea that we should look at, if we look at graduates of these elite law schools, is it much harder to become a clerk or a judge, a federal judge, if you're liberal? I think Maya had the perspective because she also attended an elite law school, so she sort of knew what the environment was like. But when we made that graph, it was just sort of wild that if you're a sort of a liberal elite law school graduate, your probability of becoming a federal judge is about a tenth as high as if you were a very conservative elite law school graduate, right? So you have this sort of labor market that emerges out of this demand for judges, which is pretty evenly split. There's, given that the political system has been pretty split between Democrats and Republicans over the last few decades, there's about 50-50, about half of judges come from each party, roughly speaking, over that period. And so, but that's not the same for the types of graduates of elite law schools, right? So law schools are generating a lot more Democratic-leaning graduates, and the demand is completely out of whack. And so that's partly why we have seen the emergence of really powerful organizations like the Federalist Society. There are counterparts on the left, but they're really not quite as important because the left doesn't, Democrats don't need to go out and sort of groom people to become judges because they have this huge pool to pull from. And the same thing's true for clerks, which is a really important professional stepping stone for a lot of lawyers. And so on the federal, on the conservative side, you've seen this federalist organization being seen as incredibly effective because they're trying to solve this sort of labor supply problem for judgeships. And that's what these sort of labor market dynamics are quite interesting as well, because they completely cut against sort of an individual's professional interests, right? Like, so if you thought that the best, if you wanted to become a judge and you were a law student, probably the best thing you could do would be become conservative, but no one does that. It's sort of like, it's like changing your entire identity. And so it is sort of this weird, but really important dynamic that we observed.
Right. So talking about this, the change and how these things might come into alignment or out of alignment with one another, the sort of the bar being more liberal on the one hand, and then the kind of powerful politicians being more conservative. And you do point to a time, of course, you mentioned, Adam, where the opposite was true, in the sort of New Deal period, where you've kind of got more conservative interests in the legal class versus a sort of more liberal on the politician side. And so, I mean, I guess just the question is just how can this change? I mean, I was thinking about Steve Tellersmeyer and the sort of alignment of the legal marketplace and the judicial marketplace, and there's sort of like a lag. But ultimately these sort of things come into alignment with one another in some way, sort of maybe not in the sort of Dalian political court approach, but just, I'm just wondering how quickly change can take place in terms of moving yourself from a situation which we saw during the New Deal era and then sort of to today, and how that might change in the future.
I have to admit, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if Adam does, but I think one missing piece in all of this is the collapse of the center right in American politics. So I think, you know, in terms of talking about the landscape of expertise, and we can focus on law students, but I think it applies more generally, the collapse of the center right is devastating. So if you don't have that, then you have many people who are on the left, and then you have one extreme on the right, and that's a very unhappy place to be, I think, at a place like Harvard Law School or Yale Law School or something like that. That would entail kind of very extreme polarization, has the potential to radicalize the people on the right kind of even further. So I know that there are conversations kind of at the level of these fancy graduate programs, certainly where I work at the Kennedy School. I think there are conversations about like, how can we diversify our faculty expertise, and how can we diversify faculty and student voices to kind of capture ideological diversity as well. And I think that's really speaking to kind of the absence of the center right as sort of a potent intellectual force on some of these campuses. So there have been kind of pushes in that direction. Like, we need to have conservative faculty members who can mentor and train kind of conservative students who are kind of supporting or representative of that center right position. I think that's where maybe Adam can like weigh in if he kind of agrees with this, but I think that's where most of the efforts have been. In terms of kind of the national political landscape, the weakness of the center right has, I think, emboldened the more right wing components of at least the Republican Party. And we're kind of seeing the effects of that definitely percolating through the judicial system in terms of the nature of the appointments that the Republican Party has made. To the federal bench, they like the judges that Donald Trump appointed were, you know, even conditional on being Republicans, they were by far more conservative than judges that were appointed by George W. Bush or the first George Bush, right? So they're moving farther to the right, and we could probably expect that a subsequent Republican administration, I mean, I guess it depends on who that would be, but we might expect that trend to continue. So that would reflect further polarization within the courts as the Republican Party moves to the right.
I think, I mean, sorry, Adam, do you want to come in on that at all?
No, I think made some really good points there, and I think she's right on.
I mean, I think it fits very much with this, a lot of this metaphor, I think, is always in the background in your great book, and that's the sort of this fault lines idea that you get these sort of tensions that kind of rise and rise and rise, and then maybe there's a sort of earthquake, and you get a sudden flurry of reforms, and obviously earthquakes are notoriously challenging to predict, aren't they? I mean, the geologists have their work cut out trying to work out whether when these plate slippages are going to happen, and I'm just... I mean, my thoughts, of course, are turning, I'm sure many of our listeners will be as well, to the Biden administration's commission on the Supreme Court and sort of considering the court's role in the constitutional system. I'm sure you're both smiling. I can see you've probably got a lot to say about this. And sort of thinking in particular about the commission's efforts to, you know, think about reforms that might help to preserve the Supreme Court's legitimacy. I mean, what does your... Adam, I mean, what does your book have to say, perhaps, about the prospect for any reforms a commission might suggest, whether or not the commission will be able to actually fulfill its mission in any substantial fashion?
So I'm actually going to pass this to Maya because this is
go for it.
So I think, so if we step back and we can think about this a couple of different ways. So thinking about the judicial tug of war framework, you know, one thing that we predict is that there are parties pulling on both sides of this tug of war and the courts are kind of in the middle. And right now the Supreme Court at least has shifted pretty far to the right. So it's a 6-3 conservative majority, or you could conceive of it as a 5-4 super conservative majority, depending on what you think about John Roberts. So it's a very conservative court that I think most political scientists would agree, all political scientists would probably agree, is quite out of step with where the public is. And it's certainly out of step with the Democratic Party, right? So in the terms of the tug of war, one, you can think of the parties as being kind of separate, and right now the Democratic Party has the reins and they're trying to pull. Now, in terms of reform, that becomes very tricky for the Supreme Court because the contours of the court, the highest court in the land, are described in the Constitution. So the Biden administration and Democrats in Congress have to work with the fact that the Constitution is clear about some things and not on others. So one thing that the Constitution is clear about is that judges should serve during a time of good behavior, which has been kind of interpreted to mean that they serve life appointments. And life appointments are not very popular for judges. So most people support some kind of term limits. Every major democracy has term limits for its highest court. It's very unusual to have a high court with lifetime appointments. So one of the consensuses coming out of the Supreme Court Reform Commission was that term limits would be really great and appear to be supported and would engender a lot of good in terms of stabilizing appointments and regularizing them so that you could avoid things like strategic retirements. But on the one hand, I think that the draft report was very aware of the fact that there could likely be very serious constitutional challenges and there would have to be a serious consideration of the constitutional issues involved. And then the other big one, I think, is court expansion. And I think that that, I'm curious to hear what Adam thinks, but I think that that one is like was considered as not being something that the commission wanted to move forward, in part because they envision kind of retaliation from the next party that occupies the White House, and that could potentially lead to an escalation in terms of the size of the Supreme Court. So I think that that one is probably not where they're going to be going. I think it's going to be more cautious. They're going to be like much more cautious in how they approach that one. And those two taken together, I think, means that we're largely going to have a status quo outcome here. I don't really see kind of how they're going to thread this needle in a way that's going to make anyone super happy, except for the people who are pushing for the status quo. Now, I think Adam and I have talked about this. There are other kinds of reforms that I think are maybe less obvious to members of the public, but could potentially be very significant, such as restricting the court from hearing certain kinds of cases, or requiring that there be a supermajority vote for things like overturning an act of Congress. As far as I can tell, that has not occupied as much attention from the commission yet, but that could potentially be an area where there could be some movement in a way that would make liberals more happy with what they write. I don't know.
That's so interesting. Is there any polling on support for that? Because I've read loads of stuff about the term limits. I mean, obviously that's massively supported by the American public. But is there anything on some of these other proposals, or are these sort of kind of on the down low at the moment?
I don't think so. But, you know, one thing that this is some other work that I have with some collaborators. One thing that's true is that people tend to underestimate how conservative the court is. I think that's going to change in the next year. Adam and I were talking before we started recording about how important some of the issues are that are coming up before the court, and the fact that it's such a strong conservative majority. I think that's maybe going to open up some people's eyes to how conservative it's become. And that we would expect would increase support for reform measures. So I haven't seen any polling on some of the other proposals, but I would be surprised if support for those proposals didn't go up pretty sharply after this year.
Right. After abortion, gun control, religious freedom.
Affirmative action, yeah.
Affirmative action, right. So just huge, huge. I mean, This is just about one of the most controversial terms coming up. It's going to be so explosive, and it's hard to see how it sidesteps that. So maybe we ought to have had this conversation in a year's time and just reflect. And I don't know, Adam, whether you wanted to add anything on that point.
Just on the sort of institutional change and fault lines framework, one quick point is when we look at the federal level, the federal courts, they have been very stable for long periods of time. When you zoom out and look at the states, so every state has sort of a court system that's structured somewhat like the federal level, but there's just amazing institutional variation. Many different ways judges are selected and chosen. There are term limits in some places. There's different ways that the lower courts are organized. And these have all, like, we've seen frequent and pretty constant change at the state level. And so we don't necessarily rule that out as something that's institutionally feasible. It just seems much harder at the federal level. And Maya brought up this point about potentially having sort of super majoritarian rules. So like have to have seven justices, for instance, agree to overturn an act of Congress as unconstitutional. I think that's a very long shot reform, because it's very hard to see how that happens without the court itself deciding to do so. But from what I've learned from writing this book with Maya, I think the real long-term reform that needs to be considered is not just how do we deal with these partisan conflicts right now, but how do we actually think of the court and sort of bring it back to a place that it can act like a more or less sort of partisan and political institution, the way that we see in a lot of Western European democracies. The court's extremely important in the UK, but it's rare that it's asked to deal with these really big issues. Like it had to weigh in on Brexit, for instance, because the legislature and parliament could not manage to do so itself. But in the US, the court's sort of this wild card that's moving everywhere. And so, you know, as someone who teaches American political institutions, the thing, if I could make one change to our system right now, would be I would get rid of the filibuster in the Senate and I would create a filibuster for the Supreme Court, just to rebalance sort of the power of those two institutions. That wouldn't be costless as a reform. Not all reforms are going to universally make things better, but I think given the trajectory of everything, that's sort of the direction that I think things should go.
It's interesting that you say that, Adam, because that ties back into what you said at the beginning, right? So there are reasons why many politicians want to punt or defer really difficult policy decisions to the Supreme Court, right? On something that's like fairly unpopular, like restricting reproductive rights, you know, you don't want to have that vote in the Senate. You want the court to deal with it. And so there are like kind of, there are like self-interested reasons why they let the court handle some of this stuff. So I don't know if like there's even an appetite for doing that because it's politically convenient to let the court handle this stuff. Like, you know, the court this year is probably going to strike down gun rights legislation across 25 states. They're going to likely overturn the use of affirmative action in like many blue states. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, members of Congress don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole.
But I mean, is the court going to want to? I mean, this is the thing, because it comes back to these points about institutional maintenance and kind of the strategic considerations. I mean, you know, do the robes and the theater help them survive? I mean, you know, how does it after this term? I mean, I think, you know, how does it sort of see itself? How does it project itself? I don't know whether, I mean, there is some work, isn't there, about Supreme Court approval and the extent to which this institution is, I mean, it certainly does better than the other institutions of federal government in terms of approval ratings on the whole, but its approval has been dropping. I don't know whether you see that as being a trend that's setting in, that it's going to, public approval of the Supreme Court's going to be decreasing over time. Or whether this is a blip and it's going to be able to bounce back after this really controversial term.
I think that the less people know about it, the higher the approval rating usually is, just because people don't know very much about it. The more that people know, the less they tend to like it. And this term is poised to, I think, kind of elucidate a lot of conservative leanings that people aren't going to be happy with. I think primarily on guns and abortion. I think affirmative action is kind of unpopular. So, you know, if that's ruled unconstitutional, I think that's probably not as big as the other issues. So I would anticipate that the approval ratings are going to continue to drop and there's going to be increasing conversations about reform. I think the question is whether, like, how low would approval and how high would anger have to go in order for that to translate into some of the things Adam is talking about. And I don't think we're there yet, but maybe we will be by the end of two or three or four years of the Kavanaugh court, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
And I think for the courts too, they're not up for re-election. And so their real fear in the long run is that people that other institutions and individuals won't listen to what the court's saying. So there's this concept of nullification that has arisen in the past in the United States, where states just simply said, we're not going to follow what the Supreme Court said. And I've just seen no discussion of that in any political circles on the left. And so I just don't think we're anywhere near where the Supreme Court would actually have to sort of pay a price for the direction it's moving. I don't know, maybe in 5 years, everything will be different, but I think that sort of like public opinion we know matters a lot, and the Supreme Court pays a lot of attention to that. And I think one thing that the Supreme Court will probably be more careful about as it moves to the right, they'll try to avoid cases like Citizens United, which became this like focal point. And so you could have maybe 10 cases that sort of erode reproductive rights in the United States, And I think the effect on public opinion is going to be much less compared to if there was just one opinion that just struck down Roe v. Wade and that was now the law of the land. And so I think there's lots of ways for the court to tread lightly in ways that will help protect its public opinion. But I think the end result will probably look pretty much the same.
That's so fascinating. Because I mean, I suppose people think that this Mississippi Jackson case is going to be the vehicle that overturns Roe v. Wade, aren't they? But I mean, I suppose the court is, I mean, this is a high information environment, right? That the judges and justices do have a pretty high degree of foreknowledge about the sorts of cases that are likely to provoke that sort of conflict and that might become, I mean, whether they're anticipated in relation to, certainly there would have been an anticipation in relation to Citizens United that this could be a very explosive case. Presumably they see that about the court, cases that they're seeing in the current term. But I mean, clearly the conversation at the moment is about the federal Supreme Court. There's a whole load of wonderful stuff in your book about state courts, and I don't want to do our listeners out of a sense of that. You give some vignettes, don't you, of various situations in which state courts have seen a sort of a backlash from the political class in terms of the movement of trying to politicize appointments as opposed to going for a more sort of non-political or merit-based approach in Florida and elsewhere and Kansas and so on. Do you think that there's a fundamental divergence? I mean, Maya mentioned this very briefly towards the beginning, between the sort of fate of the federal Supreme Court and the fate of the state courts, the lower courts, in terms of the dynamics that you describe in your book.
I can take a crack at that. So I think one of the takeaways of our work is that the forces of the tug of war, kind of the tension between the legal establishment and political actors, actually depend quite a bit on the fashion in which judges are chosen. So in some states, judges are elected. In other states, there's this system called merit commissions where groups of lawyers kind of band together and then they will propose a slate of candidates for the governor and then the governor can agree to appoint those candidates or there's some selection from that slate. But in those states, in the states that have merit commissions, lawyers are actually pretty actively involved in the selection of judges. And then, of course, at the federal level, it's basically at the behest of the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. So it's done by political actors, by politicians exclusively. So what kind of judges you end up with is really a function of that. So if you're in a system that gives a lot of leeway to politicians, it turns out that politicians will basically choose judges that they want. And so the judges in that state will look a lot like the politicians in terms of their ideologies. If you have a system that's like the federal system where politicians are appointing judges, then it's the same, right? If you have a system where it's judges are elected, then judges are going to look like the preferences of voters. And so because of that, they're going to look really similar to politicians. Whereas like in places that have like these merit commissions, they're going to look a lot like the preferences of lawyers in that state. So it actually like kind of depends a lot on the existing judicial selection system. Now, one thing that's true is that if politicians don't like what courts are starting to look like over time, they'll try to change the way judges are selected. So if they're in a state where if conservative politicians are really disliking the merit commission system and they really think that like the judges that are being selected through the merits commissions are too liberal, then guess what? They're going to push for the election of judges and they're going to push for the selection of judges by the governor. They're going to push for ways to select judges that will result in a court that's more to their liking. So one thing that you very frequently see is kind of in places where judges are elected, you'll see a push toward what we would call partisan elections, where the party of the judge is made explicit to voters. So that's like a very simple thing that could be done that would generate more judges that are to your liking if you're conservative. Mm-hmm. So it's like things like that that I think that the states, the variation across the states, you can see that more clearly with the states because there's more variation in how judges are selected. at the federal system, it's hard because in the Constitution, it says that judges have to be appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. So they're always going to be appointed by politicians, and they're always going to reflect the preferences of the politicians in power. But at the state level, you see a lot of variation, and you see a lot of push right now, as we have for the last 10 years, by primarily Republicans to shift selection more toward what we would call politicized mechanisms. So things like the partisan election of judges, selection by the governor or by the state legislative assembly, things like that.
Right, right. And you've got this wonderful empirical variation that you can exploit to look at, to try to determine that, to disentangle the effect of these different systems of mechanisms of judicial selection. And I mean, there's one thing you mentioned there, Maya, which I think we haven't talked a bit about, because we've been thinking a lot about the politicians' incentives in all of this, but you talk about lawyers' incentives. And there's a sort of another concept that is a really major plank of this book. It's not just about the judicial tug of war, which I like, a metaphor I like very much, but it's also about this idea of capture judiciary, of constitutional capture. And you've got these, so we know a lot about regulatory capture, you know, bureaucratic agencies coming to sort of be dominated by the industries that they are supposed to be regulating. But how does that analogy, Adam, work in the judicial realm?
So this idea that we develop a sort of judicial capture comes out of this notion. So so traditional sort of regulatory capture that we think about, say with the banks or railroads or these large industries, has this component that there's some governmental regulatory body, usually within the bureaucracy, that these interests can eventually sort of take hold of and sort of turn around and make it less about regulation within the public interest and more about regulating these industries in the interests of those interests themselves. So the railroads can set up a system where the regulation is very lucrative for them. In terms of the legal profession, we have a very different, but I guess more extreme dynamic. So there's a saying that the most extreme form of capture is self-regulation. So this notion that there shouldn't be a regulatory body that's external from, say, a profession or an industry. It should be the industry itself that regulates itself. And this is the outcome that lawyers in the United States have enjoyed basically forever, right? And it goes even deeper than that. So one of the things we show in the book is like lawyers in Congress are far more likely to vote in favor of legislation when it has to do with what the American Bar Association wants on an issue, especially when it comes to regulating the legal profession, say setting fee structures or saying who can become a lawyer, these types of important questions for the industry itself. But the challenge is it goes actually a little further than that, because the legal profession is, again, interesting because it's, on the one hand, it's been described as sort of a Janus figure, where you have one face of the legal profession looking towards sort of like its public role in a democracy, which it has played for a very long time. And the other face is looking towards its economic interests. It's very lucrative to be a lawyer in the United States, especially if you're at a really sort of prestigious law firm. And so you have these two tensions within the legal profession, that there's this political and then also this sort of economic set of interests. And where things really come to a head is that it's not just about lawyers regulating themselves without any input from Congress or state legislatures. They actually have complete sort of cultural, or in a way, control of the main, of the courts within the states and at the Supreme Court. So you can't become a judge in the United States, or effectively you can't become a judge if you are not already a lawyer, so part of that profession. And so you see in these states that the system of regulation that's been set up in the United States for the legal system is that judges are the only legitimate regulators of the legal profession. Now, if the courts are now your regulatory body, you care a lot about who's going to be on those courts if you care about the interests of your industry. And one of the things that we see in terms of patterns in the United States comparatively is the types of outcomes we see from the legal system really are quite troubling. So on the one hand, there are more lawyers per capita in the United States than pretty much anywhere else in the world. The legal industry in the United States is this massive, a multi-hundred billion dollar industry every year. It just dwarfs what we see in other countries. The UK is probably the closest, and that has a lot to do with intermingling and mergers between law firms between the two countries. So we have this very, very sort of lucrative and populous industry. And then you look at questions like, what is the ability of the average citizen to access and afford legal representation if they have a civil case that they need to litigate? In the United States, the United States on rankings of this measure is somewhere like 110th. It changes from year to year. Out of countries, we're behind, say, Afghanistan. Right, and so we have this massive, really powerful industry. And if you're able to afford legal services, if you're really wealthy and you can afford the best legal services, you're in great shape. It's really hard for accountability to come for you in a lot of these contexts. But if you're not part of that class, you end up you're pretty much out of luck in the United States. And I think that's pretty tragic in a lot of ways. But it's also a function of an industry that's not regulated in the interests of the public. And because lawyers do have these economic interests, they also have these political interests, they don't want to let go of that. This is the main, if you go look at the American Bar Association's mission statement, the independence of the legal profession, essentially the self-regulation of the legal profession, is their main, main central organizing sort of mission. And I think that the consequences that come out of that, I think they're not really, they haven't been really fully internalized by our political system or our public yet. And I think it's something that we really do need to grapple with when we think about reform of the legal profession.
That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I think that it really sort of ties up the sort of conversations that I think this book is really provoking us to have about not only about sort of variation in public policy outcomes and legal outcomes, but also the very foundations of democracy and of rights and of access to justice, frankly, that I think that underpins a lot of what you're saying. I have one final question for you both, and that is, what next? I mean, where, Maya, are you going next? You've mentioned a couple of things that you're working on at the moment, some projects that arise perhaps out of this book. What's next for you?
So I'm doing a work that's looking more, I guess, at the Supreme Court and the way that members of the public view the Supreme Court as being in step or out of step with public opinion. So this is work that's joint with Neil Mahotra at Stanford and Stephen Jesse at UT at the University of Texas. And we're finding in that work that the Supreme Court really is moving in a direction that puts it pretty far out to the right compared to public opinion. And we're using some kind of interesting and novel public opinion measures to try to get at that question. And a very interesting pattern that actually falls out of that is that the Supreme Court's moving pretty far to the right, but people don't perceive it as moving to the right. So people don't really appreciate just how conservative the court has become. They don't really see that, and they don't expect that. And that's particularly the case among people who are left-leaning, so Democrats. So Democrats are particularly bad at realizing that the court has moved very sharply to the right. Republicans are actually pretty good at recognizing it. I think it's because they've gotten a lot of elite messaging on this point. Like, judges are very important to the Republican Party platform. And so they've internalized that the court has shifted, but Democrats have been slower on the uptake. And so this is part of a ongoing project that we're going to be pursuing for the next foreseeable future, looking at how that changes over time. And in anticipation of like blockbuster terms such as this one, it'll be really interesting to see what happens to these dynamics.
Fantastic. How about you, Adam?
So I remember when Maya and I first met, I remember thinking, I was doing this really great work on the courts. I have all this ideology and data work that I'm doing, but the really interesting stuff that's going to go on in the next decade is in the judiciary. And I think that was a good call at the time. Right now, I'm really starting to focus more on electoral reforms And I have a feeling that that's going to bleed back into the courts. I studied the courts in a while right now. So I'm working a lot more with like understanding like different ways that states can reform electoral institutions to increase turnout. But as everything else in the American politics, all roads lead back to the Supreme Court. So we'll see.
On that note, I think that's a wonderful note for us to end. Just to say, Adam, Maya, thank you so much for speaking with me. The book is The Judicial Tug of War, How Lawyers, Politicians and Ideological Incentives Shape the American Judiciary. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.